Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you so much for the kind invitation. A little last minute. I was a student in Edith's lab, and I learned a lot about X chromosome inactivation. And also, what I realized is that not only it's a fascinating process to study by itself, but also it is really a paradigm to understand fundamental processes of gene regulation and transcriptional control, not just on the X chromosome, but also across the genome. And so my lab is now interested in following up some of the discoveries that we made in Edith's lab that relate to how chromosomes fold and how that enables transcriptional regulation and connecting enhancers with their proper targets. So I was privileged enough to work with many of you when I was in Edith's lab, and together we discovered that by studying the X chromosome inactivation center, that chromosomes fold into a series of large self-associating domains that we called topologically associating domains, or TADs. We studied the X inactivation center and realized that this organization splits the X inactivation center into two TADs, one that contains TSIX, the negative repressor of XIST, folds it together with a bunch of cis regulatory elements that activate TSIX, and at the same time insulate it away from the XIST promoter and its own enhancers that at the time we did not find, but that Eda later on discovered, and maybe we'll hear a little bit about that in a second. And this led us to propose sort of a more general principle for transcriptional control, whereby the TAD organization would enable enhancers dispersed across a large genomic neighborhood, here in blue, to target target promoters inside the same TAD, while at the same time insulating them from the promoters that are in the next TAD. And we analyzed at the time a cell line that Joost Scribno had made that serendipitously removed the TAD boundary over here, and that led to fusion, physical fusion of the neighboring TADs, and upregulation of here all the genes that were initially silent, which we at the time interpreted as the enhancers gaining physical access to those genes and now activating them ectopically. And so we were thinking that TAD organization would allow two things: putting together things that are co-regulated, and at the same time insulating things that are nearby on the linear map, but need to be insulated from each other. Then I moved from my postdoc and got really interested in what actually lies at the boundary to drive this organization. And long story short, we and many others realized that there's a transcription factor called CTCF that binds at the boundary of the TADs. And if you remove CTCF, we were early adopters of this Degron technology that I think we heard in virtually every talk this morning. If you do the CTCF Degron experiment, the TADs fuse as if you had deleted the boundaries. And when things really started to make sense is when we realized that CTCF certainly does not act alone, but actually the molecular function as we understand it today of CTCF is to block the looping activity of this cohesin complex that I'm going to describe in greater detail in a second. So that cohesin can only loop things that are inside the same TAD and cannot reel past a CTCF site. Therefore, only packaging together sequences that are flanked by the two CTCF sites. This process called DNA loop extrusion works as follows, again, as far as we understand it, and there are still many unknowns over here. But what we think is happening is cohesin lands on the DNA, probably with the help of this protein called NIPBL or NIPBL. And NIPBL also binds on and off cohesin, and when it binds cohesin, it activates the ATPase activity and the looping activity of cohesin. So cohesin goes on and on and on. It can go uninterrupted for hundreds of kilobases, until cohesin either is unloaded by a dedicated molecular machinery made of WAPOL and PDS5, or runs into the binding sites of CTCF, which we and others have shown that CTCF possesses in its N-terminus an interaction domain that basically poisons the activity of cohesin, locks it in place, so that the loops basically cannot move past CTCF. So TADs look nothing like this globular organization that I sometimes like to draw, but they are really living and breathing entities that are flanked by the CTCF sites, inside which the loops are constantly being created, extend, and dissolve in a very dynamic fashion. And so a big question that we have now is to understand how does transcription regulation and NSF promoter wiring works in such dynamic environment? To what extent is cohesin really helping all enhancers finding their targets, and what really is going on here? So this is the question I'm going to start addressing today with you. To what extent cohesin loop extrusion really supports distal enhancer action, and especially in the context of transcriptional dynamics that drives cellular differentiation? And this work was carried out by my first graduate student who just graduated last week, Clarissa Hansen. And she, if she applies to any of you, Snatcher, she's really fantastic. So quickly after we hypothesized all of the cartoon models that I showed you linking transcriptional regulation with that folding, a number of observations sort of started to upset a little bit the simplicity of this model. And I think the first one is that if you degrade cohesin, which get rid of all of the cohesin held loop, just for a very short amount of time, for 6 hours, the RNA-seq looks awfully similar to the control, meaning that the transcriptional response is very mild, and you certainly do not seem to disconnect completely. You physically disconnect the enhancers and the promoters, but the transcriptional misregulation doesn't seem to follow at least as dramatically as one might have expected. One problem here, which we're going to discuss more in a second, is that cohesin, as you know, it's also required for sister chromatid cohesion and cell division. So these assays cannot be performed on in cycling cells, and literally you have just a few hours before the cells start dying to perform these transcriptomic experiments. A second thing that that was very interesting and contrasting with our simple model was that at some loci, for example, here, this is work from Bing Ren, that reported that inserting very strong CTCF sites between the SOX2 gene in mouse CS cells and its control region, the SCR, which is absolute, it's an enhancer that is absolutely required for SOX2 expression. This only downregulates SOX2 a little bit, but certainly does not completely shut it off, meaning that the enhancer is still able to bypass those CTCF sites. These raised question, is overall simply wrong? Is it incomplete? Or are these experiments somehow maybe overinterpreted, maybe because here we cannot wait long enough to see the defects? And here again, raising the question, to what extent is SOX2 representative? And I'm going to answer no to these two questions. 6 hours was not enough, and SOX2 is not representative, and I'm going to explain exactly why. So it all started by trying first to solve this issue of cells dying because of cohesin depletion. This is high C after depleting cohesin for just 3 hours, and you see the TAD organization completely dissolves and vanishes. Everyone knows that. Everyone also knows that if you try to push the cells through one or two cell cycle, they die, the nuclei are completely distorted, the cells become completely aneuploid. You certainly do not want to profile transcription in these cells. What we realized is that if instead of depleting cohesin, you degrade the processivity factor, NBL, instead, this still allows cohesin, or small level of cohesin, to bind DNA and perform the mitotic functions, so there is no defect on cell cycle and cell proliferation. However, because the processivity factor is titrated out, the loops cannot grow and cannot extend. So now you're left with high C that looks quite similar to the complete cohesin depletion, in a sense that you've lost the long-range interactions, but the cells, you have no confounding effects on cell cycle. So now we can perform transcriptomic assays in those cells and ask how many genes move, if any, and what is the connection between enhancers and promoters. So I'm going to split the talk in three very unequal sections. One is cohesin depletion causing problems in the maintenance of transcriptional profiles? Then questions about whether it controls the transcriptional dynamics during developmental gene regulation. And finally, going back to the mechanisms for regulation by distal enhancers. So we started with a very vanilla experiment, just did plain RNA-seq 24 hours after depleting NBL. And we see lots of genes that go up and lots of genes that go down. When we started to look at the correlation between epigenomic marks and the genes that go up and down, we noticed a trend, and really it's the only pattern that really sort of popped out, which is here, this is in y-axis, the number of H3K27 acetylation peaks, and you see how it is enriched within maybe 100 to 200 kilobases of the genes that normally go down. that would go down after NBL depletion. So it means that genes that need NBL for sustained expression lie in enhancer-rich regions. Of course, as a field, we do not have a map for all the connections that would map all of the enhancers with their proper targets. So I cannot tell you exactly how many genes with bona fide enhancers are actually downregulated. I'm going to show you a couple of examples where we deploy genetic to actually chart these connections. But yeah, this is as far as the genomic correlations go. The one thing that was really striking to me is if we take the ESLs, differentiate them normally, and then repeat the NBL depletion in neural progenitor cells for 24 hours. We also see lots of genes go up and down, but there's basically no overlap between the genes that were misregulated in ESLs versus the NPCs. So whatever makes a specific gene sensitive to the loss of cohesin loop extrusion, it has to be something that is tissue specific. And again, this could be at least partly the location of enhancers that of course are gonna change between cell types. So now just a little vignette for the dynamics of transcriptional dynamics of transcription during cell differentiation. I'm not going to show you the result. I'm just going to give you the punchline, which is basically transcriptional dynamics is largely intact, meaning the genes that need to go up can still go up. The genes that need to go down still go down. And we looked at this in three different cellular transitions. The first one is the exit of pluripotency when you just withdraw the LIF in ESLs. We also pushed the NPCs into astrocytes. And with Elzo de Witt, we also did this gastruloid differentiation that we heard about earlier. And again, in all cases, we see that the cell type specific markers are, most for the very large part, preserved. So loop extrusion doesn't seem to be a strict requirement, or proper loop extrusion doesn't seem to be a strict requirement for the developmental dynamics. This occurs in the context of many other genes being dysregulated. Those are not specifically the developmental genes. So now going back to the question of, out of the genes that go down, how many were actually regulated by enhancers? And are there genes that we know are regulated by enhancers somehow independent of this cohesin loop extrusion mechanism? And the answer was really, really striking. The first gene that we looked at was the SOX2 gene because it's the most characterized in the field for its dependence to this long-range control element. And that SOX2 is barely going down after NBL depletion, maybe 20%, even after 4 days of depletion. However, if we just went down the list of genes that are downregulated in ESLs over here, we saw many examples where a single gene over here lies far away from candidate enhancers, and for those genes, we see expression going down quite a bit. So we decided that maybe this actually can give us an opportunity to understand why some genes like SOX2 seem to operate long-range interaction, long-range regulation independently of the DNA loop extrusion, whereas for other loci like CAR2, it's way more required. So I'm going to start describing a little bit about CAR2 and then go back to explain why is SOX2 so resistant to the loss of cohesin. So CAR2 was not characterized at all in ESL, so there was a lot of grunt work to be done. So we used the system to simplify a little bit the analysis that relies on introducing a GFP reporter on one allele and an RFP on the other allele. When we use these cells and we deplete NBL for a few days, we see a very nice downregulation that recapitulates what we see by RNA-seq. This system is useful because then we can go in and torture the green allele by deleting the enhancer, moving them around, etc., without touching the RFP allele, and we look at the allelic ratio in single cells as a way to normalize out any possible confounding trans effect that could arise. So again, we leave the red allele as a control, and then we deleted either one, the other one, or both candidate enhancers, and we see that both candidate enhancers contribute to CAR2 expression, and you need to remove both to lose expression completely. We know again that CAR2 expression goes down after depleting NBL, but this could very well be an indirect effect. So in order to really demonstrate that CAR2 expression is relying on DNA looping between the enhancer and the promoter, we inserted very strong CTCF sites between the enhancer and the promoter, which again are going to block loop extrusion, and this resulted in complete downregulation of the gene. It was just as bad as removing the enhancers completely. So that gene is extremely reliant on cohesin loop extrusion, that's why we picked it up with the NBL depletion. But why is it so reliant on this DNA looping mechanism? Our first hypothesis was because the answers are far away. So to test this, Clarissa made a bunch of cell lines where she reinserted either of the enhancers by knocking them in at various positions across the locus and asked whether the CAR2 expression, it becomes maybe independent of loop extrusion after a certain distance. So here I'm showing you the basal expression in cells that have normal DNA looping after you reinsert the enhancer either at its normal location or closer and closer and closer. So what you see already is at baseline, the closer you reinsert the enhancer, the higher the expression is. It maybe is not too surprising. Long-range regulation works better if it's not that long range. But what was more interesting to us is to look at the fold change after NBL depletion. And what we saw is that the further away you are, the more downregulated you get after depleting NBL. And there seems to be a bit of a threshold here, which is about around 20 kilobases, where CAR2 expression was remained completely stable after depleting NBL. So the answer was yes, CAR2 is sensitive or so reliant on cohesin loop extrusion because its enhancers are far, and you can alleviate this dependence by bringing the enhancer closer. We saw the same trend when we repeated the exact, or I say we, but Clarissa did everything. When Clarissa repeated the same reinsertion experiment with the other enhancer, there is some slight differences, but the trend is overall the same, and the threshold is again the same, about 20 kilobase. So that was satisfying, and maybe not too surprising. You need cohesin looping for distal regulation, not for proximal regulation. But it was not satisfying because it completely because it did not explain why is SOX2 so resilient to the loss of loop extrusion. The enhancer is also located over 100 kilobase away, and SOX2 remained very stable. So our initial hypothesis was maybe the SOX2 enhancer is so powerful and so mighty, it is so strong, it can activate target genes independently of loop extrusion. So to test that, Clarissa repeated the knock-in experiment, but this time with the SOX2 experiment. So taking the SOX2 enhancer and putting it at the CAR2 locus. And the basal expression is higher, consistent with the SCR being stronger than the CAR2 enhancers, but the trend of downregulation remained exactly the same, meaning that the CAR2 locus, driven by the SOX2 enhancer, remained equally sensitive to the loss of DNA loop extrusion. So sensitivity to NBL is not encoded by the enhancer sequence. It is encoded by something else at the locus. That was very clear, but also meant we had to switch our assays to study SOX2 now, because it meant that there's something at the SOX2 locus that makes it independent of loop extrusion. So we switched to SOX2, and this was a little bit daunting because there's many more. CAR2 is a pretty quiet locus. There is only the two putative enhancers. SOX2 is very, very busy. There's lots of DNase 1 hypersensitive sites, lots of weak enhancers, some stronger ones. And so now I'm going to switch to bar graph to show you the experiments that show you the transcriptional response of the SOX2 locus after either before depletion in gold or after 1, 2, or 3 days of depletion. And again, it's the allelic ratio between the tortured allele and the control allele. SOX2, as I explained earlier, if you deplete NBL, is not very sensitive to the loss of cohesin loop extrusion. If you delete the distal enhancer altogether, SOX2 expression crashes completely, as expected. But when we switch the strong SOX2 enhancer for the CAR2 enhancer, which is weaker, again, the SOX2 locus remained entirely insensitive to the loss of extrusion. Again, telling us that there's something in the SOX2 locus that is not the enhancer that drives the resilience of the locus. We tried to sensitize the locus by pushing the SOX2 enhancer really far away, 365 kb away, which downregulates basal expression, maybe creates some sensitivity, but the locus remains largely insensitive. So again, it means that there must be some tangible or intangible property of the locus that may be a hidden regulatory element that basically drives or sustains distal regulation by the enhancer independently of cohesin looping. So there were many possible candidate elements, and we simply went by them one by one, brute force. So I'm going to cut a very long story short and show you the only thing that worked. which was the deletion of 1 kb elements called the SOX2 regulatory region 2, that is 3 kb downstream of SOX2. That does not, when you delete it, SOX2 expression is not altered at baseline, but now when you deplete an EBL, expression crashes. So somehow this element, which is a very weak enhancer, is sustaining a pathway independently of cohesin loop expression to enable the distal enhancer to communicate with the target gene. This is not something that is an artifact from these highly engineered cells. When we went back to wild-type cells, or mostly wild-type cells that where we hadn't touched the SOX2 locus at all, if we deplete an EBL for up to 4 days, the cells don't really differentiate. But if we repeat an EBL depletion in the context of having removed this SR2 deletion, now we see that the cells differentiate, which is probably reflecting the strong downregulation of the SOX2 locus. And again, these cells don't have any GFP or RFP or anything that could skew the result. So the working model that we have so far, and this is something we put on bioarchive, and after I'll show you a little bit more than what was on the bioarchive, but we think that the default behavior for distal enhancers is actually to rely heavily on cohesin loop extrusion, so that when you remove cohesin loop extrusion by an EBL depletion, for example, you prevent DNA looping between the enhancer and the promoter, and you prevent this long-range communication. There are additional loci where genomic context provides an additional parallel redundant pathway for this cohesin-dependent interaction by using these proximal enhancers that basically act as buffers. And we don't really understand the mechanism, but the genetic is very clear. This creates an axis that is cohesin-independent that enables the promoter to basically sense the presence of the distal enhancer. And it's if you remove the cohesin axis, this axis persists. And it's only if you remove this element on top of removing the cohesin axis that now you see downregulation. So that, of course, raised key questions. How does this SR2 element work? Is it special? Is its position 3 kb downstream really important? Can it work elsewhere? And what is the molecular mechanism? So very briefly, is SR2 special? Absolutely not. We could replace the SR2 by any weak enhancer that we found, either in a genome on completely unrelated chromosomes, or even from the SOX2 locus. If we grab one of those weak enhancers that is normally further away from the locus and cannot synergize, and we use it to rescue the deletion of the SR2, now we can restore the independence of the locus to cohesin loop extrusion. So this ability to synergize seems to be a pretty degenerate feature of weak enhancers, certainly not something that evolves through compatibility with the SCR, with the SOX2 enhancer and the SOX2. We can also repeat these experiments when we replace the SOX2 enhancer by the CAR2 enhancer, and it also works. So again, this is a general property of enhancers, it seems, not specific to SOX2. So what might be specific to SOX2 is that this element lies so close to the target gene. And so to test whether this is really important, we grab the line where we had removed SR2 and we reinsert it at different location. If you put it 2 kb upstream, you can restore the resilience of the locus to the loss of cohesin extrusion. 17 kb largely works as well. 43 kb does not work anymore. So again, you need to be within this 20 kb-ish range, which we had at the CAR2 locus identified as the cohesin-independent genomic radius, for these weak elements to deliver the information to the target gene. This element is only required if the distal main enhancer is far away. If you bring the distal enhancer really close, so we grab that element and we the main enhancer, and we bring it really, really close. If you bring it below 20 kb, it doesn't require this SR2 element. This SR2 element is only required if you're distal. So again, highlighting the importance of genomic location. This is what I just said. So can we take the SR2, put it at CAR2, and render CAR2 more, or protect CAR2 from the loss of cohesin extrusion? The answer is a little bit, not completely. Carissa inserted CAR2 3 kb downstream of the promoter here, and in many different collections of alleles. She compared the CAR2 locus that is driven by its endogenous enhancers or by the SOX2 enhancer. And here, the normal CAR2 allele, the RFP control allele, is going to go down because it is sensitive to cookies in loop extrusion. So if the green allele is protected by SRR2, the allelic ratio are going to become larger than one. So here we're looking for things that would overshoot. And when Carissa inserted the SRR2 on an allele that is devoid of all enhancers, you can see that the over time, the allele overshoots a little bit. That is because this enhancer is driving weak cohesin-independent regulation because it's so close. But that was what was more striking is that when we had insist both the SR2 and the enhancers, either the main CAR2 enhancers or the SOX2 enhancer, here we see much higher baseline that is sustained after over time. So yes, you can elicit this synergy simply by combining the enhancers at a locus that had not evolved at all this mechanism. Something that was really, really striking to me is that, again, if you insert the SRR2 too far here at 18 kb, it doesn't sustain or it doesn't synergize. But if on this allele that does not synergize, you invert the transcription unit, bringing the promoter only 5 kb away, now you can elicit again the synergy. So again, this has to do with the distance between this proximal element that has to be within about 20 kilobase to elicit this behavior. Now I would like to discuss very briefly more natural context. Cells don't really experience NIBL degradation. It's something that we do completely artificially to get rid of cohesin. But cells do inhibit loop extrusion across CTCF sites. That's one of the functions of CTCF. And as I showed you, by studying the SOX2 locus, CTCF site knock-ins did not fully silence or insulate the target gene. And we thought that maybe it's because SRR2 is present and mediates this cohesin-independent regulatory access. So what happens if we remove SRR2 and put the CTCF site knock-in? Do we now fully insulate SOX2? The answer is yes. This is the normal SOX2 allele. Expression is set to 1. If you delete the distal enhancer, of course, expression goes down. I showed that to you. If you delete SRR2 only, not much happens. If you put the CTCF site with everyone else present, you only downregulate about twofold, which is what consistent with Bing-Ren's observation. But now, when we remove the SRR2, you lose expression. So indeed, it means that this CTCF bypass was mediated by the presence of this SR2. And again, these cohesin-dependent interactions that are inhibited by CTCF can be bypassed by this cohesin-independent regulatory synergy with promoter proximal elements. And we can recreate this completely de novo at the CAR2 locus. If we grab the CAR2 locus that does not have a promoter proximal element, I'm just going to switch here. I showed you earlier that adding the CTCF site completely silences and insulates the target gene. But if you add SR2, you bypass the CTCF site. So mechanisms, we have no idea. we know, I'm just going to show you the last little bit of data. But of course, one idea was that somehow this enhancer could provide cohesin-independent looping and interactions that would not be affected by the loss of cohesin loop extrusion. So ELSO helped us to analyze some force data. This is just normal wild-type cells at the SOX2 locus when we anchor the viewpoint at the enhancer. And you see the loss of interaction when we deplete NIBL. You still have some that are left. But when we compare to what happens after removing both NIBL and the SR2, we still see this loss of interaction. And now if I grab the NIBL depleted wild type and SR2 and overlay them, they are largely similar. So it's not like you're maintaining proper long range interactions, at least as we can detect by 4C. There could be some higher order organization that is not captured by these assays, but so far we just don't know what could be the mechanism. So this is the summary, but I think I just explained everything. So I'm just going to switch to the acknowledgement and highlight Carissa and Annie, who is also a fantastic research assistant, and our collaborators, Elzo, for many discussions and helping with the 4C, Jeff with help for the RNA-seq analysis, and Robert Blaylock's lab for help with some epigenomics. And thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.